speaking of the economics of happiness, of well-being, in 2010, Great Britain became one of the first countries in the world to create a national measure of well-being, a gross national happiness index. Britain's one of the centers of the new happiness economics, thanks in large part to the work of Lord Richard Layard, an internationally renowned economist. Steve Paulson caught up with him at a recent conference on global well-being.
Lord Richard, you were one of the first economists to study happiness. Why would an economist even want to work on this strange subject of happiness?
Well, actually, the people who founded economics, you know, in the 18th century, Adam Smith, those sort of people, thought that what they were doing was trying to find out what conditions, what social arrangements, what economic arrangements were conducive to the happiness of the people. Well, you know, Thomas Jefferson said that was the only point of government. So it's not a new idea in economics, but I think what went wrong was that economists began to doubt their ability to interpret whether people were happy or not. And they thought, well, the only thing we can be sure of is if they've got money in their pockets.
Mm. So economics really became more a matter of measuring prosperity, right? I mean, that was considered
that's what happened to it. And we got to this extraordinary situation where the gross national product became the sort of talisman of virility of a country. And of course, the evidence then accumulated over time from the 1950s onwards. In the States, which was the first country where happiness was being measured systematically, it wasn't growing, although the people were becoming very much more rich.
So income was rising, but happiness was not rising.
Yeah, yes. By the 70s, people were saying, why is this? And they found that probably the main reason was that people were measuring their happiness against some standard, some norm, and the norm probably being mainly what other people had. And there's now a huge amount of evidence that people assess their income in large part relative to the income of other people.
I think this is a really important point to make. So you're saying it's not absolute income that really matters so much in terms of people's happiness. It's how well we're doing next to the other guy. It's how we stack up. And if it seems like the other guy is getting ahead, then we're not going to be as happy.
Yeah, so this is, if you like, a zero-sum game, because, of course, it's impossible for one person to become relatively richer without somebody else becoming relatively poorer. And if you actually look at the causes of happiness, you will find that a tiny part of it is due to their relative income, actually not much more than 2%. But we can explain something like a third of it by other factors, the most important external factors being the human relationships, especially, of course, in the family, but also whether you have work, what your work is like. But even more important, actually, the internal factors. And mental health is the dominant internal factor. And physical health, of course, becomes very important later in life. But during working age, mental health is the single most important determinant of a person's happiness.
When you talk about mental health, you're talking about not being overly angry. I mean, what are the factors?
I'm talking
of mental
about mental illness, meaning depression or quite specific anxieties, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress, these kinds of disorders. These account for something like, at the clinical level, 16% or so of a population. And one of the conclusions that I've come to is that, you know, if we were thinking about how a society should be organized better to promote happiness, one of the most obvious things is that we should be spending much more on providing psychological therapies for people with depression and anxiety disorders. These are quite effective treatments now.
So you're saying from a public policy perspective, I mean, one thing that a country really could do to enhance the well-being of its population is to get more people into therapy so that they feel better.
Yes, not endless psychoanalysis where the evidence of its effects is quite limited, but these short therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy with thousands of randomized trials that show their power. These are the things that ought to be relatively liberally provided by insurance systems around the world. So you've got this extraordinary situation where, for example, depression is a much more debilitating condition than diabetes. Depression, anxiety disorders are accounting for something like 40% of all absenteeism, if you're thinking of it from the employer's point of view. And yet, 90% of people with diabetes are in treatment, and not more than a third of people with depression, even severe depression, not more than a half. I mean, this is absolutely shocking.
Well, so then to return to our first question, what does an economist bring to this study of happiness as opposed to, say, a psychologist or a psychotherapist? Yeah. You're saying that there are public policy implications here?
Yeah, I think there are two things that an economist brings. First, he brings this idea that you should allocate resources, money, on the basis of the benefits that you can get per unit of money spent. So the question is, how do you measure the benefits? Now, economists who have become enslaved to the gross national product will measure the benefits in purely money terms, output. But that is not, of course, a proper measure. The right measure is the extra happiness produced and misery relieved.
And you can actually measure happiness.
And this is what we can now measure.
It sounds like what you're saying then is that really the bottom line for what economics should focus on is maximizing happiness for the greatest number of people, the classic utilitarian argument.
That is what it should be. The other thing I think where economists are quite good is in thinking seriously about the questions of cost. Now, if you look at, for example, the net cost to the provider, say the healthcare system, of providing psychological therapy, well, what is it? Obviously, the gross cost is the cost of employing the therapist, but the net cost has got to take into account the savings which will come about because a person who is less depressed, less anxious, goes to the doctor less often for physical problems. Even though they're getting the extra cost of psychological therapy, they cost the insurance system less in total because they go to the doctor less for physical illnesses.
Now, you've said that GDP is the wrong measure. This is not the sign of success of a culture. So I guess the question is, what is? If GDP is not the answer, what should be the bottom line measurements that a government should be trying to achieve on behalf of its people?
Oh, I think whether people are satisfied with their lives. And this is now what has been introduced in Britain. We now have a regular annual official government survey of how satisfied people are with their lives. The OECD, the Club of Rich Nations, including the United States, has produced a manual published this year of standard ways of measuring it.
So the question then is, will political leaders actually pay attention to the results of these well-being surveys?
Yeah. Well, there is a lot of support in many countries. I was just invited last week to go and meet with Mrs. Merkel, which
in Germany.
Surprised me. Mr. Sarkozy, of course, started it off in France. England has perhaps gone faster than any other country so far. But there's interest in every country, I would say. And it does require, of course, the political leaders to pick it up and run with it.
Richard Layard is the director of the Well-Being Program at the London School of Economics Center for Economic Performance. And he's the author of the book Happiness, Lessons from a New Science. In 2012, he co-edited the World Happiness Report. Steve Paulson talked with him.